Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 172, and we're galloping back to cover the effect of the Boers' 33 articles approved by the Volksraad on April 9th, 1844, thus installing the little Republic of Potchefstroom. Some of the articles and the fledgling laws and rules were going to crop up throughout the history of South Africa, all the way through to the time of apartheid and even to the present. If you recall, the Natal Boers and the Vaal Boers had been in dispute, largely because of the difference of opinion between their two leaders, Hendrik Potgieter on the Highveld and Andries Pretorius, who'd been based in Natal. With the British declaring sovereignty over Natal, many voortrekkers upped and offed, trekking back over the Drakensberg to the Trans-Orangia and up along the Vaal, and some ended up even further north. So we're going to take a look at this period. In 1849, there was a temporary union between the communities north of the Vaal, who adopted the basis of what was to become the Transvaal Constitution. This constitution was only repealed in 1901, when its provisions ceased to be applicable. That is, except for the application of the Roman-Dutch system of law. The thing to keep in mind was that the 33 articles can't be regarded as a formal constitution. For a start, there was no definition of various authorities in the state, and most of the 33 articles were concerned with the procedure in the courts. When it came to matters of government, even the most elementary kind, the articles were silent. Each emergency that arose subsequent to its ratification in 1844 led to a rewriting of the articles to cover the gaps in how to manage the state. Even the Volksraad was referred to in the vaguest terms possible. Often, when disputes arose, another constitution, that of the Winbach Boers, regulated the articles. These articles provided for annual sessions of the Volksraad, and for whose election lists of voters were to be framed. The executive offices of this republic under construction were the commandants, the assistant commandants, the field cornets, and assistant field cornets. They had to obey the Raad's decisions, and these commandants led any commandos of military formations on behalf of the Raad. Military service was mandatory for all Boers living within the region, with the field cornet keeping a list of names he could call on to mobilize when required. If any member moved from one ward to another, he had to tell the cornet within 2 weeks. There were rules about building homesteads or property too near to others, and no black people were allowed to settle near any of the Boer villages. It was this rule that was often broken, because in the original 33 articles, it came with a rider that said that black people could not settle near the villages to the detriment of the inhabitants. So what began to happen was local black residents who worked for the Boers were allowed to construct themselves little dwellings a short distance away so that they could walk to work where required. This was not to the detriment of the inhabitants. But what was more murky was that the Volksraad had to be consulted before these areas we now call townships were constructed. Anyone disobeying the law, which as I've explained was pretty much all the trekkers all the time, and when they felt like it, would be apprehended by the field cornet when he felt like it. However, this was not justice as we know it. The major crimes were treason and murder, but the list was fairly lengthy. Crimes included rioting, forgery by officials, issue of false medical certificates, perjury, assault, slander, theft, breach of the peace, refusing to serve on commando, opening letters without permission, insults to the chastity of women, kidnapping black children, and ill-treating servants. It was the ill-treating of servant laws that were partly responsible for the voortrekkers leaving the Cape in the first case. This was a law that was loosely enforced, to say the least. When the apprehended Boer arrived in court, this court was actually a committee of the Raad itself, and all proceedings were open door. Penalties for contempt of court were announced, and an accused person had the right to challenge members of the court. This was important because everyone knew everyone. So there were often accusations of malice of forethought aimed at committee members, or partiality at least. At first, all appeared to go smoothly in the Republic of Potchefstroom until it didn't. The old tendency to dissension arose, although the cause was fairly obscure. Potgieter and Pretorius maintained their cold distance from each other. Potgieter, according to historians, was dictatorial and had always tested the patience of even those who maintained their support for him through thick and thin. By the end of the first sitting of the Volksraad, these tensions rose, driving a wedge between Port Gieter and a significant section of that body. Another character we've met pops up again. Johan Arnold Smelikamp, a citizen of the Netherlands. If you remember a previous podcast, he popped up in Natal and told the Volksraad in Pietermaritzburg that the Dutch royal family was taking an active interest in the Voortrekkers. That was stretching the truth, and had many members of the Volksraad convinced that if they fought the English for Natal, the Dutch would come to their aid. Holland, of course, did not. Smelikamp had worked as supercargo for the Amsterdam trading company of J.A. Klein & Co., under the direction of a man called Ulrich. The latter also is important, as you'll hear shortly. Just to explain, a supercargo, as the word comes from Spanish sobrecargo, is a person employed on board a ship by the owner of the actual cargo carried on that ship. Supercargoes would manage the cargo owner's trade, selling the merchandise and ports to which the vessel was sailing and buying and receiving goods to be carried on the return journey. Smelikamp made a first voyage to Port Natal in 1841 with the objective of establishing trading contacts with the Voortrekkers, who had just declared Natalia Republic only 2 years before. And as you know, at the time of Smelikamp's arrival, the British under Captain Thomas Charlton Smith were several days marching away from Port Natal, ready to occupy the town. The rest you know. Smelikamp loved the attention he got in Pietermaritzburg. The Volksraad gave some promises about trade in the future and put in a request for immigrants to strengthen the Boer state. Smelikamp travelled back to the Netherlands via Cape Town, but was arrested at Swellendam because he did not have the proper travel documents. In the meantime, the British government started official correspondence with the Dutch government about Smelikamp's activities in Natal, being convinced he was an agitator, which of course he was. King William II of the Netherlands rejected the proposed connection between Holland and the Voortrekkers, and before the year was out, he apologized to the British for the affray caused by Smelikamp and his activities. This didn't stop the self-aggrandizing Smelikamp, who returned to Natal in 1843, but was refused entry into Port Natal by the British. So he sailed to Delagoa Bay instead, and after the creation of the 33 Articles in 1844, and the declaration of independence by the Potchefstroom Republic under Hendrik Potgieter, Smelikamp popped up once again, riding into Potch that very winter. This is where things get more interesting. Potgieter began a series of discussions with Smelikamp, who advised him to move his people north of the 26th degree of latitude, outside of the British sphere of influence, and with an opportunity to trade there freely with other Dutch traders. Considering that Port Gieter was now a powerful Voortrekker leader of the Republic of Potchefstroom, why would he do that? Well, things were not as they appeared. It was the Voortrekker's most ardent aspiration to have a spiritual leader trained thoroughly in the tenets of the Church of their fathers. So far, they'd been forced to accept a pastiche of Wesleyans and even an American called Daniel Lindley. They also wanted a sound education for their children in Dutch, and the succession of partly trained schoolmeesters were not considered fully worthy. So Port Gieter fell under the influence of Smelikamp, who apparently had the gift of the gab. He had managed to convince the Pietermaritzburg Volksraad to support his grandiose claims. Now he turned the full glare of his laser-like eyes on Port Gieter. Smelikamp was not alone when he rode into Potch that winter's day back in 1844. Riding alongside him was Predikant Pier N. Ham, a man that Smelikamp claimed was a fully-fledged, 100% trained, ordained, and envisioned minister. Still alive, but barely, was our old friend Erasmus Smit, who was the unofficial Predikant and also was on his last legs. Smelikamp had convinced a well-educated schoolmeester called Martineau to join him on this trip as well. But Ham's wife died of fever within a few weeks, and the Voortrekker's new predikant was bereft. The bereftness turned to embarrassment when the Natal Voortrekkers did some sleuthing and found out that Ham was not fully ordained at all, so he left for the Cape. Smelikamp's other trump card, the teacher Martineau, died of fever as well. The bad news did not daunt our top A spin doctor Smelikamp, because he continued to urge Port Gieter to leave the Potch Volksraad and to found a new settlement closer to Delagoa Bay. he met with Smelikamba once more, who pointed out that if the trekkers trekked just north of the 25th degree of south latitude, the English were no longer able to wield any control over the voortrekkers. Port Heater had been obsessing about how to loosen the grip the British had over products the Boers produced. They wanted their own trade route through a port the English didn't control, so moving northeast would kill two birds with one stone. They'd move away from the English and closer to Delagoa Bay, where the Portuguese ruled the roost. Every now and again in the history of a nation, a man or woman appears who is apparently too good to be true. Smelikamp, like others who've made themselves known in the 21st century, could weave a convincing narrative peppered with explosive phrases, a man of smoke and mirrors. Let me read to you from Uit die geskiedenis van die ZAR en van die Afrikaners by C.N.J. Du Plessis. If you're interested in reading it, the 345-page Dutch history can be found online. A digital copy is available on the Internet Archive in the Netherlands. So, Du Plessis quotes a trekker from Maritzburg who observed, "At that time, a certain Mr. J.A. Smelikamp came to Pietermaritzburg, and as it is merely our old fault often to trust Europeans too much, this is what the Boers did with Smelikamp." The poor Volksraad paid him £150, and our source quoted by Du Plessis continued, "After he had first been worshipped like a little idol, he went back to Holland." Ouch. Well, partly owing to Smelikamp's persuasion, and partly driven by his own obsessions, Port Heater made the fateful decision to organize a new trek at the end of 1844, heading towards Delagoa Bay. After the recce, he took a large group of voortrekkers with him. But he didn't completely burn his bridges with the Potchefstroom Republic and told the Volksraad he was merely extending the infant country's territory. After a few weeks, they arrived at a site they called Blade Rivier, Happy River. Port Heater believed that this site was only 3 days' ride from the sea. He was wrong. They set up a new settlement and promptly named it Andries Oorgstad. Later, that was contracted to merely Oorgstad. Port Heater believed it was possible to link this entity to the Republic of Potchefstroom. The reality was these trekkers were now many days' ride away, and the farmers were not content to be governed by legislature so far to the west. When Port Heater's wagons rolled onto the hills of Oorgstad, of course, they were not empty of people. And this again is where the story gets a little more interesting. The plot thickens to a consistency of treacle, because the people he met there were the Bapedi, who had been forced out of their ancestral land by the Amandebele of Mzilikazi 2 decades earlier. There is a propensity by the thicket of politicians we live amongst to clump people together like blocks of colourful Lego, the white pieces with the white pieces, the black with the black. The beauty of our land is that it's not quite so simple. Take a look at the map and the location of Iswatini, the relationship between the land we used to call Swaziland and the Republic of Oorgstad is complex because when Port Heater arrived in 1845, he had first decided he'd ignore the Bapedi people. Next door, or to be geographically accurate, southeast of Oorgstad, Swaziland in the mid-19th century was very far from being the integrated society usually implied in contemporary descriptions. As Philip Bonner, the great historian, has shown, when Mswati I succeeded Sobhuza in about 1839, he inherited a kingdom on which only a very fragile unity had been imposed. Then, and for a generation to come, Swazi society continued to divide along both horizontal and vertical lines of cleavage. Horizontal, because many of the chiefdoms incorporated by Sobhuza in the centre and north of Swaziland remained culturally and linguistically differentiated from their Ngwani royal line rulers, so that an unstable ethnic stratification ran through Swazi society, and vertical because the characteristic Nguni propensity for fission within ruling lineages had yet to be fully contained by these evolving institutions of the early Swazi state and was always threatening to fracture it into competing principalities. What this means in English is that there was a contested power ethos. When Sobhuza I died, these lines of division were reinforced. Princes began to jostle for precedence, while the less privileged lines began to test the bonds that tied them to the state. A man presumed to be one of the minor chiefs of the time, Mswati I, was pushed ahead of a number of Sobhuza's other eligible elder sons. One of these was a marginalized man called Fokoti. He was in charge of a chiefdom in the south of what is now Eswatini, and it was here that he launched his rebellion against Mswati, who was only about 16 at the time of his accession. The coup attempt, if we can call it that, was abortive. It failed because it was mismanaged by Fokoti. He was judged as more dangerous to the Swazi kingdom than his younger brother. The rebellion subsided. But it had focused attention on the most extreme Ngoni family weaknesses, and once again, it is a woman who appears in the record as significant at this moment. Mswati's mother, Tandile, was born in the Amandwandwe Empire, further south, closer to Shaka. Some say it was this experience that led to her organizing the entire social structure of her son's empire around a military administrative system. She copied the Amandwandwe, the Amaqwabe, the AmaZulu, by sorting her people into nationwide age regiments. Watching these changes with a powerful group of regional chiefs who did not take too kindly to fiddling about with their power networks. The Emakanzambili and other regional chiefs rejected some of these social changes. This was going on before the Voortrekkers rocked up. Potita, of course, had no idea about all of these goings-ons. Mswati was circumcised in 1845, but it's unclear if he took over full control of his people immediately, because oral history speaks of his elder brother, Sonkuba, who was designated to negotiate with the Urgstadt Boers. But with his circumcision in that year, it marked the first stage of Mswati's assumption of full power of kingship. It also marked a period of increased tension that emerged from within the royal family. At the heart of this friction was Mswati's elder brother, Malambule, who, like Mswati, could boast of a mother who was directly descended from King Zwide of the Amandwandwe. Malambule had also been part of the group of regents who'd helped rule the kingdom while Mswati was growing up after Zabuza I's death. So he found it difficult to consider his younger brother as now his principal ruler. Malambule had approached AmaZulu King Mpande for diplomatic support and convinced the missionary James Allison to also back his claims of being the rightful king of the Swazis. Born in Carlisle in England, Allison became a missionary at the Wesleyan Methodist Church, arriving at the Cape in 1820. He left the Cape and then founded Mount Mohamba Zion in Swaziland in the 1840s. As Malambule went about building his case, he ignored the most powerful possible ally he could have had in the region, called the Voortrekkers. There were only a few hundred now living around Urgstadt with Potgieter, but they had already had an impact. For Mswati, however, they offered a piece of unlooked-for good fortune, as historian Philip Bonner notes in a Journal of African History article published in 1978. Complex machinations were going on both sides. Potgieter was facing his own set of issues, and so was Mswati. Potgieter had negotiated an agreement with Bapedi chief Sekwati, where the Trekkers had agreed to protect the Bapedi from the marauding Swazi warriors in exchange for farms. When Mswati approached Potgieter with offers to assist dealing with local issues, including a promise to wipe out the Bapedi on the Boer's behalf, the Boer Commandant General was brusque in his rejection of the Swazi monarch, saying to obtain any concessions from the Swazi would have been self-defeating and merely duplicated the agreement he already had with Sekwati. But, as I said, there were complex machinations going on inside the Voortrekker political system at this time. Potgieter was under a lot of pressure by other Boers at Urgstadt. The quarrel was deep and linked to proponents of two systems of government. The one in which all authority was vested in a civilian-elected Volksraad, and the other in the autocratic and personalized leadership of individual military commanders. Potgieter, being an individual military commander, preferred the latter. The others did not. So the Sekwati agreement was inevitably tied to Potgieter himself, integral to his predominance and his style of highly personalized government. He was personal and informal, which further complicated any attempts at dealing with issues of the day, as you can well imagine. It gave the aging commander a grip on any branch of external or internal affairs, which his opponents inside the Voortrekker organization found very difficult to loosen or to swallow. This was going to have important implications for the Swazi, the Bapedi, and the people of Urgstadt, as you're going to hear next episode. What was also going to have an important implication was an outbreak of extremely deadly malaria. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to have a little update about this episode. You can also register for my newsletter. Until next, tot ziens.